three big benefits that people are going to receive from the Down 40 Love podcast. Number one, you're going to be inspired. These conversations with great people like American film producer Hawk Koch are like positivity pills that give you the energy to go out and crush your goals. Number two, you're going to build resilience. Down 40 Love is a tennis metaphor for turning adversity into competitive advantage. On the podcast, we share stories, strategies, and actionable steps so that you not only stay in the game, but you elevate your game to the next level. And three, you're going to get better. Listen, there's nothing worse than wasted potential. As a leader, you already know that. And it's also your greatest fear. By listening to Down 40 Love and applying the lessons to what's going on in your life, you'll become a master at turning setbacks into bounce backs and much, much more. Are you ready? Let's go. Doug Conant played D1 collegiate tennis at Northwestern before serving in the corner office as president at Nabisco, president and CEO at the Campbell Soup Company, and chairman at Avon Products. Today, Doug serves as founder and CEO at Conant Leadership, a mission-driven community of leaders and learners who are championing leadership that works in the 21st century. Doug, the Dominator, welcome to Down 40 Love.
Well, hey, it's the first time I've been called the Dominator, but I like it. It has a nice ring to it.
We have a lot of nicknames. I worked for a coach by the name of Greg Patton at Boise State, formerly at Cal Irvine, and Greg was a master at nicknames. And I found when you talk about leadership, it really helps establish your culture because everyone likes to be recognized. And if you can find a nickname that can boost someone's confidence, it goes a long way. So hopefully you've taken it in good stride.
Yeah. No, that's great. And that, as you and I talked briefly before we came on air, leadership is personal. And to the degree you can, when you're coaching people, you can make them comfortable and lift their sights a little higher. It's amazing what they can do.
So I'm excited that we're connecting today, in particular because of your tennis background. You know, Doug, you played collegiate tennis at Northwestern, which has a strong history of success on the court, and Northwestern's academic prowess is well known globally. Can you give us a little bit of background on how you got involved in competitive tennis and how it led you to Northwestern?
Oh, yeah. I could talk all day on this subject, but I know we only have a half hour. The thumbnail sketch is I started tennis very late in life, maybe 12 years old. And I was pretty athletic, but not real athletic. I was very introverted. And I discovered, you know, I could hit against a wall all by myself. And it worked. I tried out for the freshman high school tennis team when I got to New Trier High School in Winnetka, Illinois. And they took like over 20 people, and I was cut from that team. I couldn't make the freshman team at this high school. And then I kept hitting against the wall and by myself while all my friends went off to tennis practice. And I had a good run, and by the next 3 years, my last year of the 16s, my 2 years in the 18s, I was one of the better players in the Midwest. At the time, it was the Western Tennis Association, and Northwestern happened to be about 10 miles away from where I grew up, and the coach there was Claire Reeson, his son Marty Reeson. Had a great career at Northwestern and a great career professionally. And Coach Reeson was aware of me because I was in the Chicagoland area and the Chicagoland Tennis District Association. And I had the opportunity to go 10 miles away from home, get a free education at a great school. And I took him up on it. But I was still learning and growing. I can remember going to Kalamazoo and for the 16s and the 18s. And I was just getting my feet wet. And it's really an neophyte at that level. And getting a chance to see all these people play and then to play against them. I think my big four tournaments were always, nationally were the hard courts in St. Louis at the time. You could fry an egg on those courts in the summer. and the clay courts, which were in Louisville, the Westerns, which were in Ohio somewhere, I can't remember where, and then the Nationals in Kalamazoo. And it was such a great broadening experience in the juniors. And then I had a chance to play all over the place with Northwestern for 4 years. Then I had a chance to stay and help coach and get my graduate degree. So, you know, Northwestern opened doors for me well beyond the tennis world, which, you know, I'll be forever grateful for. But the tennis was good, was great. I played second singles and first doubles my last 3 years there, two, 3 years. And one of my best friends, who's now my lawyer, I met him the first day of tennis practice at Northwestern. He was a walk-on. And he ultimately went on to be president of the USTA. And his name was and is John Vagosen. And John is a real tennis fixture in the global game of tennis. Then we worked, John and I worked together on the heels of all that on the board of trustees at the International Tennis Hall of Fame for a long time as well.
It's amazing all of the relationships that you develop through being competitive in sport. Doug, what were 2 to 3 life lessons that you took and that you continue to take with you from being a competitive tennis player?
Well, I'll rattle off a few, but I did write a blog on this, Life Lessons from the Game of Tennis. And if anybody's interested in Googling it, I've shared that list at ITA events and other things that I've spoken at. But one thing I learned was that I had to be totally accountable for my performance. I couldn't have somebody else doing it for me. And I alluded to this in some remarks I made for David Benjamin the other day. And because you've got to have a mindset that 10 two-letter words, if it is to be, it is up to me. You got to own it. You can't. It's not up to someone. You got to own it. You got to own it when you're on the court, and you got to own it before you get on the court. And so I learned that, and that sense of total accountability is essential not only in tennis but in life. Another lesson I learned is that, you know what? Practice may not perfect, but practice may not make you perfect, but it is required to get good. You got to work at it. If you want to excel at anything in life, I wanted to excel at tennis. I had to pour myself into it. And not just on the court, but I also had to be a student of the sport and see how people were playing points and learn the craft. You had to pour yourself into it. So if you want to excel at anything in life, ultimately I chose business, you got to pour yourself into it. So if it is to be, it's up to me. And practice is hard work. You got to work at it. You got to work at your craft. You apprentice at it, and you increasingly master it. You never totally master it. And I guess the third thing, it came from a book that Billie Jean wrote, which was, you know, everybody knows this language because Billie Jean wrote it. Everybody in the tennis world, and that was pressure is a privilege. You know, I went into the corporate world ultimately, and I saw a lot of people wilting under pressure in a boardroom or in a meeting. In the fullness of time, I did not, because I had learned on the tennis court that it was up to me, that if I was prepared when I went on the court, I could handle anything that was thrown at me, even though I might lose. And I started to engage in my matches and then in my life with this mindset that, aren't I lucky to be here? And I can handle this pressure better than the other guy. And let's go. Let's mix it up. Now I may lose, but I started looking at pressure as a privilege. And so those were three things that, you know, you only learn it from pouring yourself into an endeavor like tennis and living it for a while and being all in. And I know you know what I'm talking about. You've been there, done that. So those are three that I would highlight. But I think I had a baker's dozen on that blog, Life Lessons. There's so many lessons. You and I both know that, that we pick up from trying to excel in any endeavor with a real commitment over time to being excellent at it. And those were three lessons I took into the corporate world that helped me a lot.
I love that you started with ownership because everything begins there. Everything begins with taking 100% responsibility for not only the process, but for our outcomes. You know, and in a sport like tennis, there's so many elements that we can blame, where we can place or look to place the responsibility on something else, whether it's the wind, whether it's a bad line call, you know, whether it's an opponent who, you know, is not maybe behaving, you know, or acting like a good sport. There's so many outlets, yeah, you know, where we can pass the buck, so to speak. Doug, why did you choose to get into business?
Well, it was clear tennis wasn't going to be my opportunity area, and I wanted to learn and grow. And I had this unique opportunity to stay at Northwestern and go to the Kellogg School of Business, which is one of the three best business schools in the world, at the age of 22, and stay connected to the tennis world and get my business degree. So I did. And I found it was a whole new world opening up to me, but that I could sort of apply those life lessons to it. And that if I poured myself into it, I took total accountability, I worked hard at it, and I embraced the pressure of the moment, that it could be incredibly fulfilling. I also liked what was good about business for me, and I'm an introvert. I've taken the Myers-Briggs test 5 times. And like all introverts, I mean, in different company, different places, but in all of us introverts, we want one time to be an extrovert. You know, I sort of want to naturally be the life of the party, not have to work so hard at it. But never worked for me. But I did love to see people prospering in my own introverted way. And what I loved about the business world is it was really just a community of people trying to get something done. And so I loved the business. I loved the community of it. Mm-hmm. I was working with people who were working hard to support their families and to see their kids prosper and to honor their parents and to create careers for themselves. They were pouring themselves into it, and I admired that. And so all of a sudden I was in this huge ocean of business people all trying to figure it out. And I sort of felt like I would be able to figure it out. That having been said, I was slow because I had been doing tennis so long. And everybody I worked with had sort of a business mindset before they got there. I came right off the tennis courts to start my first job at General Mills in Minneapolis. I had been teaching down at, I don't remember where, probably Florida. And I started, and I had a khaki suit, like a tennis player, a yellow shirt, a Madras tie, brown earth shoes. I had a Fu Manchu mustache. I had Afro hair. I had the tan line where I wore my headband. And I went to work, and I showed up at work, and everybody had a white shirt, a blue suit, and a red tie on with wingtips. And I show up. And it was like, whoa, culture shock. And but you know what? 6 months later, I found I could retain my identity as an individual, but I could also play the game. And I found it fascinating trying to work my way into that world. But I was slow. I got fired relatively early on in my career. And but I did ultimately figure it out.
Well, you certainly figured it out. I mean, I find it fascinating that, you know, you've always seen yourself as an introvert, right? But inside of you, you had this desire, which may be even stronger than you knew, to be the life of the party. Well, you were CEO at three huge global organizations. By virtue of you being CEO, you were the life of the party. Every time you walked in the room, eyes were on you by virtue just of your position alone. Now, how you led on a day-to-day basis, that's a different story, so to speak. By virtue of your position, you were in the spotlight.
Well, I was, but the way I got the position was by leading effectively. But I did get the position, and I was president of Nabisco. I was CEO of Campbell. I was chairman of Avon. All big jobs, but I was CEO once. Set the record straight.
Okay.
But I think the key was to be able to, knowing I was introverted. One of my best friends, a good friend, is a woman by the name of Susan Cain, who is the champion for introverts. She wrote the book Quiet, and she would tell you that the most untapped resource in any company are the introverts, because companies aren't built to listen to them. They're built to listen to the people that are talking.
Yeah.
I am an introvert, but you know, we're probably going to get into this because I think it's essential for navigating today, is you have to have courage to walk into that room when you're an introvert. I mean, you got to double down. You got to be ready to go in, because you're not excited about going into that room. An extrovert can't wait to get in that room.
Yeah.
An introvert's saying, holy shit, I got to go in there. I better have my act together. I better be accountable. I better have worked hard. I better be well-grounded. I better have a pressure as a privilege mindset. And I think that's what's required for people today when they're going into these. I mean, it's a chaotic world. When you're going into this chaotic world, whether it's athletically or professionally, you have to really be well anchored in who you are and how you want to show up. And I have this belief that it takes courage, you know. And Maya Angelou has this quote about courage, and she says basically it's the mother skill. It's the one attribute you have to have, because you can't practice any other attribute if you don't have courage, because you will wilt. So you have to have courage. And when I think about courage, I believe that a lot of the leaders, a lot of the people that might be listening to this podcast want to have courage, but they don't know where to go to get it. And I can only say that it's hard to display the courage of your convictions if you don't know what your convictions are. And I think that's the root of the problem. Most people don't know where they want to stand on things. They're trying to just get by and respond to this crazy world that's coming at them. They don't know where they want to stand. And what we do in my work now is we try and help people get really well anchored with who they are. We tell them your life story is your leadership story. And it's where you will find the courage to perform. You got to go deep into your world and figure out what you want to stand for. And then you got to bring it forward in the world at large. Most of us have gone into the world and we start taking our cues from, well, our teacher wants us to do this. My coach wants me to do this. My professor, my parents, and so, or my boss. We're all listening to what everybody else wants us to do, but we're not sure, what do we want to, you know, where do I, what do I want to do? Brené Brown, another friend, has a great quote. She said, look, you can either stand inside of your story and own it, or you can stand outside of your story and hustle for your worthiness every day. And that's what I see a lot of tennis players doing. They're taking these cues from everyone else. They're not standing inside their story, and they're hustling. They're hustling to feel worthy every day. I see it. Same thing's true with business people. They're hustling for their worthiness every day. Somewhere along the line, we all took these incredible cues we learned in life because we sort of know what's how we should be, how we want to be. But we put them in the parking lot while we're trying to make everybody else happy. And what I learned in tennis was if I was really well-grounded when I went into a situation, I could show up there. And I could do it effectively in the fullness of time. If I didn't know the answer, I don't know. But if I did, I could show up. And I think that's where a lot of aspiring leaders today who are just swamped with, I got to get home to feed the kids. I got to get home to do this. I got to show up at work. They want this done by when? And, oh, I'll finish this after we put the kids to bed tonight. They're just swamped. And they're saying, well, where do I go to figure this out? And I would say you go in. All the answers are in you. And only you can figure this out. You have to own the journey. If it is to be, it is up to me. And so that's what's essential. And ultimately, you build courage like it's a muscle. You're not all of a sudden able to do it. You work it and you build that muscle over time. You practice at it. You put yourself in smaller situations where you can see how you do, and you go into bigger situations. But courage is the key, and it's hard to find. It's so funny, though. It's all inside, and we're all looking outside. What does Tony Robbins think I ought to do? You know, what does Doug Kona think I ought to do? No. It's all in there. You know what you grew up, you know what your values are. You learn them from your parents and your grandparents and your neighborhood. You know how you need to show up to feel good about yourself. But somehow people lose sight of that. And helping them, there's no better feeling right now. All I do is help people find their true north inside. And gosh, it's such a good feeling when you see these little aha moments where of course I know how I want to show up, but I can't show up that way at work. Well, the reality is if you don't, you probably will never get anywhere at work. You have to show up that way. You have to be your authentic self. I'm on a soapbox. I'll get off for a while.
Well, you have a great story, you know, to build on that with Lou Gerstner, just in terms of, I did read a little bit of your book, The Blueprint. Yeah. You know, it's fantastic. It takes some time. It's very in depth. It is work. I read the chapter on courage and it's great. Can you share, you know, how that experience went down, maybe what led up to that chat with Lou and what you learned from it?
For those of your listeners who don't know, Lou Gerstner was the wildly successful chairman and CEO of IBM. Before that, he was the chairman of RJR Nabisco, which was the world's largest LBO. Still one of the three largest in history. When a private equity firm, KKR, and a consortium of other investors acquired the company, and they hired Lou to help run it and spin it off eventually. He was doing a good job, and then he was recruited to IBM to do a great job at IBM. But he was a scary guy. He just loved poking at you, you know? And I was hired by the CEO of Nabisco to come run their tiniest division. And they had my wife and I come to New York, and we were going to have dinner with the CEO and his wife. And that's what I thought I was there for. The CEO said, well, you know, Lou would just like to say hello to you, just like to introduce, meet you. And I thought it was just a meet and greet. And he was like a god at the time in the corporate world. You know, it would be like,
yeah,
he was a god. And so I went into his corner office in New York City, and he looked at me and said, why in the world should we hire you? You know, what are your credentials to do this job? Have you ever done anything like this before? And I thought I was just going to say hello to him. And I was trying to be polite for the longest time. And he kept pushing me. And I'm an introvert and I'm shy. I know it's hard to tell from this conversation. I was just not ready for this. And he knew it and he was reveling in it. And so he just, and I finally said, well, you know what, Lou? It's pretty clear to me that you don't know your ass from your elbow about how to run a consumer food business. I do. And I don't really need this job. I'm doing just fine where I am. And I was. So if I'm not if I don't have the right qualities to do this job, you shouldn't hire me. And then he looked at me and he had this wry smile on his face. And he basically said, I wish I could remember the words exactly, but he basically said, well, it's about time you stood up for yourself, you know, because he was testing me. It was a stress test. He was going to wait for me to push back. And I did. I finally found the place. I went to the place where I had the courage. I knew what I was. I knew I could do this job. And I just had to stand up and be counted. And I was one of the few people that actually enjoyed working with him after that. I saw it as, okay, I'm going to see Lou again. Here comes the test. Let's go. Pressure is a privilege. I'm going to own it. I've worked hard. I'm ready. Let's go. Let's mix it up. And I go back to my tennis roots of starting there. And I just didn't have that natural talent to be great at tennis. I had the talent to be good. But I had the talent to be effective with other people in the work environment. And a big part of that was developing the courage of my convictions.
Well, successful people like to work with successful people. And, you know, Lou wanted to, you know, to see if you were willing to step up and talk like a peer, you know, yes man. And I speak from experience. I mean, in my 20s, I was fortunate to interact with a lot of CEOs through tennis, you know, at a Westchester country club. So, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I got a chance to see some of these leaders in finance and in business and in investment banking, how they interact socially, how they interact in competitive situations on a tennis court. And you learn a lot, you know, when you pay attention. Doug, what does Down 40 Love mean to you?
Well, here we go. It's like, here we go. Let's get it on. It's pressure. And I can't wait to play the next point. And it's time to rise to the occasion. I got to kick it up a notch. I got to be smart about it. But, now is the time. I played my best tennis when I was not always, but on balance, I played my best tennis when I was in a competitive match and I was down. And I had trouble playing with the lead. I just love the pressure of match play. And so being down 40 love to me was, okay, let's go. Let's kick it up a notch. And let's bring it on. And you sort of need that mindset when you're in business. If you're not ready to kick it up a notch and deal with the pressure of that moment, you're not going to have many more moments where you'll have an opportunity to. So that's what it means to me.
Well, I mean, Mark Cuban said, you know, that professional athletes have it easy, so to speak, you know, because business is 24/7, and the professional athletes are competing maybe 6 months a year. If it's baseball, I don't know if it's 10 for them or whatever. It doesn't matter. Tennis, actually, they're out there almost 12 months, you know, during the year doing something, some form of training, playing Grand Slams. You know, you were fired at 32. I'm sure that wasn't the only time that you experienced a setback. Doug, what specific strategies could you share with us around building resilience in our lives and work?
Well, this is where I learned the lesson of your life story is your leadership story. When I was fired, I was sent to an outplacement counselor who was, his name was Neil McKenna. He's a fantastic guy. He was actually running the outplacement program for Harvard Business School graduates in Cambridge as well. And he had his own practice, and I was one of the youngest people he was working with at the time. And the first thing he had you do was you had to write your entire life story, handwritten. Of course, I'm old, but so most people, handwriting wasn't such a foreign idea, but he wanted handwritten, not typed. And he wanted everything you could think of. I ended up, and he said, I want it in 2 weeks. So I said, I don't have time to spend 2 weeks writing my life story. I got to get a job. I've got a wife, two small children, and a very big mortgage and not a big severance package. What, you know, I'm not going to. He said, this is the perfect time to write it. You're not working. So get to work. So I wrote it. I wrote my life story. And then we had a couple weeks where we were doing sessions. And then the third session after he had gotten it, he had read it. And he had spent enough time with me. And he said, Doug, I don't get it. I don't get it. I read about your family's life story, your parents, your grandparents, where they came from, how they persevered. You've got an amazing family here. You have amazing roots and DNA. Your family persevered in this country and found their way to levels of contribution that are important and meaningful. And I have this quiet introvert sitting in a cubicle, just keeping his head down, trying to do the work, you know, which is admirable. But that's not all of you. That's not who you are. I'm not seeing that fierce competitor. You're a fierce competitor. I don't see it in the workplace. Well, I'm keeping my head down and I'm introverted and I'm shy and I don't yet have the courage of my convictions. And he said, these are two different people. I need the person that wrote this life story showing up for these interviews. They're two different people. You need to get in touch with your roots and your life story, and you need to bring that to the forefront because this is about you. And that's where I developed this perspective at the age of 32, that it's hard to display the courage of your convictions if you don't know what your convictions are, if you put your life story in the parking lot, and you're trying to be what you think they want to see when you're going for an interview. Because you got to get a job and you got to bring home a paycheck and all that stuff. And that's where it began to dawn on me. It took me a long time that I needed to just kick it up a notch and own this thing in a much more substantial way and be authentic in that ownership. And so that's what I did. And I eventually got a job barely before my severance ran out. But I got back on the horse and I started to discover, you know, I can be courageous and I not only survive, but I can thrive and be myself at the same time. See, wherever you are in the world, whatever organization you're in, the organization has a set of values. You remember the old Venn diagrams we had in grade school?
Yes.
Yeah. There's the organization values, and then they're your values, your life story. And I found that in every organization, there's this big crosshatched area in the middle where your life story can overlap meaningfully. Those attributes can overlap meaningfully with the values of the organization that you're part of. And so I start to see it's not about seeing how I'm different from everybody else and trying to protect myself there. It's more about engaging on the things that are the same. And so I started to see that, you know, there are a lot of good people here. They all want to do the same things. I can be myself and, you know, and I'll be fine. And in fact, the more I became myself, the better I did, which was like counterintuitive to when I started. And I was just trying to do whatever it took to make my boss happy. So that's where it went. It started. I think I started the book that you read. The first introduction was about that incident where it started to dawn on me that there's a better way, and it's all on a path towards being your authentic self while you honor other people.
Sometimes we need to be kicked out on our ass to even start thinking about courage. You know, when the more I listen to your story, I mean, you were winning. I mean, really from the beginning. I mean, you picked up a tennis racket at 12 and achieved a lot within a 10-year span. I mean, more than most who, like myself, picked up a racket when I was 5 years old and you're feeling burned out by 12 or 13. Okay? Yeah. So, you know, you were winning, and then you went to Northwestern. You're winning in the classroom. Then you get into the workforce. You're winning. And then at 32, boom, you know, you get fired. You know, it's a setback. It's the first time it's ever happened. You start thinking in a different way. And as cliche as it sounds, you know, we often learn more from our losses than our wins. And you mentioned Tony Robbins earlier in our conversation, you know, and he talks about, you know, when people succeed, they tend to party. When they fail, they start to ponder. And it's so true. Yeah. Doug, what would you like your legacy to be?
Well, I've sort of landed on what matters to me, and it grew out of my life story. And I want to be known as someone who honored all the people that I was with on my journey. And honored them and in some way helped them have a better life experience. I go back to Neil McKenna, my outplacement concert. When I was fired, I won't tell the whole that story, but I was fired. I was in shock. I went home, and ultimately they said, but we hooked you up with this outplacement counselor, you should call him. I called him at the end of that day, and he answered the phone, and he said, hello, this is Neil McKenna, how can I help? And every time this was landlines. We had push button phones then, but that was about it. We had no caller ID or anything. Every time Neil answered the phone, he would say, hello, it's Neil McKenna. How can I help? You could be the plumber or the mechanic calling to tell him his car is ready to be picked up, and he's there to help. He set the tone with every conversation. He was there to help. And he led an amazing life. He led an amazing life with this maniacal commitment to be helpful to people. And that inspired me to go back to my roots and to honor and help people. And that's what I do now. I've run Inconant Leadership for, 12 years now. I don't get paid for it. we charge for a few things, but that's so we can pay the people that work there. And if we make any more than that, the people that work there, people I work with, get to choose where we give it away to, what nonprofit organization we give it to. And so I feel like I'm living into, this is what I was meant to do, just to be helpful to people in ways that work for them. And so that's my legacy. That's the legacy I hope to have created when all is said and done. Of course, I plan to live to 120, and I'm only 73, so I got a long way to go.
You do.
But anyhow.
You do. That's funny you mention that, because I share with friends that I have a 50-year plan, and they look at me like, what? You have a 50-year plan?
There you go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm glad that I'm not alone, you know, in terms of thinking big.
In fact, you're too short term, actually.
Exactly. I'm too short term.
Yeah, 100%. Maybe we'll talk separately on that. I'll help you out.
100%. I want to thank you, and you don't need any validation from me. I really appreciate what you're doing. I've always had a deep respect for successful business people because my dad was one, you know, in a time when there were very few minorities who started businesses and were able to operate them successfully. So I grew up in that environment. But I think even more so, you know, related to your story, you know, you've gotten to the mountaintop more than once, and now you've created a system and processes to share with as many people as possible, and you're really leading with generosity, and for that I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for your time that you've given us today.
Thank you, and I just want to make a postscript to that. What I learned in my work was I needed every day to lead with generosity. It's not when you're done that you start being generous. It's the whole journey, leading with generosity every day and helping others every day. And once I started to lean into that, I did better. So this, you know, a lot of people think it's okay, now you've made it, now you can pay it forward, which is nice. But what I discovered was, gosh, leading with generosity, you can't start soon enough. And that's what you're doing now with your podcast. So I salute your work as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. You're great.
All right. All the best.
Hey. Hey, before you go, thanks so much for listening. If you got value from this show, chances are your community will too. Please share this link with a friend or mention the podcast on social. That's a big time benefit for us, and hopefully in exchange for providing insight and big ideas to you. I also want to go the extra mile today and give you an opportunity to connect with me further by downloading a free copy of my new book, Down 40 Love, Private Lessons on Turning Adversity into Competitive Advantage. It's my personal manifesto on building resilience in every aspect of your life. Now go put today's episode into practice, because dominance is daily. Are you ready? Let's go.